The invisible hand contains sensitive material that could threaten the safety of our contributors. To protect the identities of those involved, we will mostly be using first names or pseudonyms. Content warning. This series contains graphic audio relating to animal cruelty and some violent themes which may be distressing to some listeners. These episodes were written to be listened to chronologically. This is Chapter 8, A Child Cannot Pay for Its Mother's Milk.
Hello, Domingos. But can you just tell me what you're doing?
Yes, watching my baby boy, the car, the fancy one.
I thought you meant your brother. Yeah. In the car.
Yes, I'm in the car because when we went to Mwamba, it was after rain and we messed it all. Is that correct?
Messed it up?
Yeah, we messed it all up. It needed this bath. To be washing my car, it feels really cool here at home in the morning.
You're so proud.
I'm so proud.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Thanks.
Cool. Let me walk.
During my time in Sabi village, I heard about another young white woman called Rachel. Rachel had come to Mozambique as a teacher during her Masters of Applied Science Education. While in Sabi village, Rachel conducted a small qualitative research project and compiled a report on the local boys and their schooling. She observed that there was little incentive for boys to stay in school, little incentive pragmatically or personally, for either financial reasons or a sense of accomplished self. This, she observed, was partially due to how few employment opportunities are being offered to these boys, which require a formal education and through which they can gain recognition within their community. With this in mind, Rachel concluded that there is a direct correlation between this lack of incentive or care for these boys and their futures and the allure of rhino poaching. The locals I've interviewed whilst being here and the academics we've spoken to since all echo this. My name is Georgina Savage, and you're listening to The Invisible Hand. Chapter 8. A child cannot pay for its mother's milk.
Ready to talk?
Yes.
So, Domingos.
Good morning, Georgina.
We're driving back into Mwamba to get some petrol and some supplies, etc. So I thought it'd be a good opportunity to just check in with you and see how you've been finding it.
I'm learning a lot from this experience. I'm learning a lot from my community because I'm listening to them explaining someone like how they feel about everything, about the community, like their life stories. It's really cool. I'm having real fun driving this fancy car. I wanted to inspire especially young people, teenagers that are still going to school, that they don't really need just to go pushing in order to have some good opportunities like I'm having.
What to you does the car or a car represent? Like symbolically?
A car, just a regular car, it's really good and important for us and it represents success because public transports here are not as accessible as it is in other countries, I would say, you know. Having a car is like a need, like one of the basic needs for us. Do you understand that? But still not accessible for us, not like a... affordable for us. So if you can have enough money to buy your own car, you're good because you can do everything you want. Mm-hmm. Any car represents freedom because you can do whatever you want whenever you want. And a fancy car would represent like success. You're a successful man if you have a fancy car and you are free.
I thought Domingo's pride in the car was purely superficial. Hearing him talk like this, I realize it's more complex. In a place where value systems are changing and access to opportunities and wealth are sparse. Moments of pride can feel rare. For Domingos, the schoolboy, driving around in this car has become a real source of pride. It's a rainy day in Sabi. A nice little break from the crazy, crazy heat that we've experienced.
Exactly. I like rain because, yes, rain brings a lot of things. Brings food because, yes, some vegetables will grow now. And today we just received an invitation from a neighbor to go to her house because she has marula beer, which is called wukanyu in the local language. That's a marula beer, traditional and seasonal beer. That's so exciting.
You are so excited.
Yes. Yes, I am.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you? Thank
you.
I'm Georgina.
I'm Samuel.
I'll take my shoes off or no?
There is no need. Just get
okay.
It. There is no need. Does that work for me too? Yeah.
We've arrived at the Marula beer party. A group of people, mostly men, are sitting in a circle on plastic chairs. In the centre is a large white bucket with a cloudy yellow liquid in it. They take turns in pouring a glass for one another. Domingos begins to tell me about his uncle, Samuel.
When I talk to young people around about how important it is to work with what you like, to have your dream job, for example, I take my uncle here as an example, seriously. He loves working with education. He's now become a principal. Are you still a principal? Yeah, he's a principal at primary school, but this guy loves his job. We need that a lot here in Mozambique to have people who work with education because they like it. When I'm thinking of educational system in Mozambique, I never stop thinking of D. Samuel.
So what do you think about that?
You say the truth. I love what I do.
This is Samuel. He's the principal at a primary school in Rosano Garcia, a small town near the border to South Africa. This is his family home, where his parents live. His wife is sitting on the couch at the opposite end of the room watching TV whilst we're chatting. His son is here too, an energetic toddler climbing over his dad as he talks to me. What do you think about the role of education in Mozambique and this society right now?
Yeah, it's hard now. It is hard. Yeah, it's tough. They are implementing a lot of things now. From 2017 to now, they are changing a lot of things.
Like trying to make it better or?
Yeah, they are trying to make it better, but it's not getting better. Some things are falling apart.
We're a few hours into the Marula beer party. People are loosening up. João, Domingo's father, who I don't see too much, is animated and chatting to me excitedly in a combination of broken English, Shangana and Portuguese. He's looking dapper in a hat and button-up shirt. There's lots of laughter as the men joke around with one another, filling up each other's cup with milky liquid from the bucket in the centre. Sam pours me a glass. It's potent, so I'm pacing myself. He tells me drinking is an important part of the culture here.
Everyone drinks here. And if you don't drink, you are not going to get anything to do here. Yeah. I think they drink because of that.
Like boredom?
Yeah. Yeah, they drink because of that. Some of the men were not working, while wives, even my uncle with a red shirt, with a red T-shirt.
Just over there, yep.
He does not even work. Even now, he's not working. But his wife is working. She used to go to the farm. Then she comes back, she starts cooking, but he just stays at home. He goes out just for having fun. He drinks only. Yeah, she does everything. He doesn't care about that. There were people who started with me. They just left school. They didn't see what school will bring to them. They left it, but now the things are different.
So the attitudes towards education is changing.
It is changing. A lot of people are starting now. They are starting. Yeah. They started to realize that there is a need to start. I am an example here where I am. I'm working now. I'm working for the government. I am an example. Yeah, I can see people who finished grade 12, but they didn't have an opportunity to work in a good company. Here, I think you saw, there is a banana plantation, there is a farm here. A lot of people are working there, and they earn, I think it's 4,000 per month. They start working from 6 to 5, 6 in the morning, 5 p.m.
How many days a week?
From Monday to Saturday, yeah.
It's a lot.
It's too long. They're just working for money. They need money. They just need money.
And what do you think, like, being educated does for self-esteem?
It is important. And when you do things like what I do, you know how to use your money at the end of the day. You know how to use it. I have some friends who went there to the park for that illegal thing. I think you know it. They were hunting rhinos there. They got a lot of money, but they didn't do anything with that money. A boy of the age of 20 with 1.something million, but where he's living now, I'm sorry, even my house is bigger than his.
And why do you think they didn't know how to spend their money properly?
You have to suffer first, and you earn your money, then you will know how to use it. If you get a lot of money from today to tomorrow, you are not going to use it properly. When you are educated, you will know how to use the money. You will know how to use it.
Yeah. What did they buy?
Beer. They are paying girls. You see, it was normal. One guy to hang around with 5 or 6 ladies, you see, just to show off. They bought cars. You see, someone without a place to live, he bought a car of 400,000. It's crazy. It's madness. It's madness. There is nothing to show for it.
And so they have to go back to the park.
You see. And some are being killed. I started with someone who just died, I think, 3 weeks ago, yeah. They killed him there. He went there, I think it was for the 50th time.
50? And he died.
Died there.
Okay, so Tio Bernardo.
Yes, it's a pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you so much for meeting with me to have a little chat.
Oh, thank you. Thank you to know you also.
This is Tio Bernardo. Tio is an affectionate term here for uncle, which is how Domingos refers to him. Bernardo works in Sabi as a farmer. He works for a South African company with white owners. He tells me it's becoming more and more common that South Africans are setting up shop here. It's cheaper. We're sitting on the bench on the edge of a field of tomatoes, beautifully lined to the horizon. There's a strong breeze in the air. Bernardo and I met at a small bar. He overheard us talking about this documentary. He's one of the few people here who speaks English.
Yes, I born here in Sabi, but I grew up in South Africa. I left the country in the early 80s. I went to South Africa just because of civil war. I was so young, my grandmother's got a home there in Johannesburg. I spent my 11 years in South Africa. I went to school, but I have to go back because my roots is here. I left South Africa just because of some political reason. It was a transition that time, political transition. In my area where I was living, was a lot of violence. My grandmother says you have to go back home because here we are no longer safe.
So you are talking about the transition period from apartheid government to the ANC?
Yeah, I'm talking about that. Was a lot of violence that time in my area. It was a lot of Inkatha, ANC. Also the South African police who used to kill people that time. You call them dead force. Sometimes you wake up in the morning, you find people lying down, it's dead, it's killing by those dead force. If you are innocent, you are not innocent, they beat you in the road. As long as you are black, South Africa was really, really divided country that time because of that system of apartheid. That system, that police of apartheid, they say must divide them and rule them. so many tribes in South Africa, Tswana, Zulu, Swazi, Shangaan, but they are living in their own homelands. In the same country, you see, it was divided country. The coloureds, Indian in one side, the white, the Europeans one side, you see. It was not a good life that time. It was not a good life that time. The apartheid is already in papers, it's abolished. But inside the heart of the black people and white people in South Africa is still there. Yeah, the reconciliation was not sufficient just to remove inside your heart and mind that system. Because even now, South Africa is still a dangerous place to live. The white, the black, they don't trust each other. Yeah, you can see that that mentality is still there. They don't want to change. Yeah, they are still living the past. The white people still have that problem of supremacy. They are still in economical empowerment, you know. They still have that economy in their hands. That's why they always they try to dominate the black people, because they still have that power. The real freedom is it's economical freedom. Freedom without economy in your hands is not a freedom. Yeah. That's why the white people, they still believe that we are still superior. But they are still superior because most of the companies in South Africa, the farmers, everything, still they are in their own hands.
Just on the concept of white supremacy, do you feel that people psychologically need to believe that they're superior to another race in order to justify exploiting them?
Yes, you know, the colonization, we are still injured in our mentality. They still believe that the white is like a god, a white man is like a god, especially the old people. But the generation that are coming now, they are trying to change. Say, no, we are the same. We are differ by skin. The only thing that God give the white man is knowledge, to transfer that knowledge for other people. But they are selfish. They don't want to transfer that knowledge, because if you want to be, you want to become a rich man, you have to have skills. You have to have good knowledge for business. But we don't have those knowledge. But the white people, they keep that knowledge, they keep that resources for them, just to exploit us for many years, you see.
And so how is that playing out more specifically in Sabi or in Mozambique?
Yeah, we have a lot of opportunities, but we don't have somebody who can support us. This Sabi is an agricultural area. We have a plenty of land. We can do a lot for us, for ourselves, for economical empowerment. But the government don't give us a boost, you see. Mm. The doors are open, but without resources, I cannot get far. Yeah, the doors are open. Our government is open to the doors, but they don't give us some resources. Yeah, and the system of education, I blame too much the system of education that we are getting.
Yeah, the system of education seems to be the one thing that every single person I'm speaking to says is the main barrier between empowerment of any kind.
Yeah, if you want your country to become economical stronger, the first of all is to make the system of education adequate for everyone. We have so many young people that are interested in agriculture, but no one is pushing us. Now they are promising. The president just said in a inaugural speech, now he says we'll give the 10% in our budget for agriculture. Let us hope it's going to happen. Oh, it's a lie. Politics always is lie. We are trying, but it's difficult. The barriers are too many in front of us. But the only thing that can remove our barriers, I cannot talk to my generation. My generation is already lost generation. For the future, it's education, the system of education. We need to transform that system. Yeah. This generation cannot relax. They have to stand up and fight for their rights. Because if they are relaxed, I think this country will be in disaster.
economies and weak systems of governance have created the situation in which there are no pathways into adulthood for young people.
That's Professor Alcinda Hondwana talking to Sophie.
Well, my name is Alcinda Hondwana. I'm an anthropologist and centennial professor at the London School of Economics and Political Science in the UK. I'm also the strategic director of the Firoz Lalji Center for Africa at LSE. Yeah, and I am originally from Mozambique as well. Well, the concept of waithood, it's trying to understand this kind of limbo situation, waiting for something. So waiting for their adulthood. They are no longer the children that need care and attention, but they are not yet the independent adults that can take care of themselves, contribute to society, take care of others, pay taxes, etc., and kind of look forward to their independent future. So it's this kind of twilight zone, this kind of being in a transition that never ends. Weak economies and weak systems of governance have created a situation in which there are no pathways into adulthood for young people, being it because the educational system is very weak and doesn't prepare them adequately for the job market, being it because there is a disconnect between job markets and educational systems, being it because the job market is incapable of creating jobs and absorbing people coming out of the educational system, or being it because a large sector of the population doesn't have access to education. And so, in a sense, I don't look at waithood as just being an economic issue or a social economic issue, but also a political issue.
When considering this concept of waithood, I think about the young men in Sabi caught in this twilight zone and how poaching may seem like an appealing pathway to an independent future. I've been living in Sabi for nearly 2 weeks. I'm struggling to find someone who will discuss their experience poaching on tape. One day, towards the end of my stay, Domingos gets a call. This man doesn't want to be identified, so I can't know his name. For our purposes, I'm going to call him Elio. We meet at night, and I bring some beers floating in an icy cool box. We meet in a nondescript hut with a corrugated iron roof, mud walls, and dirt floor. There's no electricity. Domingos puts his iPhone on the floor, with the torch facing upwards, emphasizing the shadows on our faces. We sit on 3 stools, one for me, one for Domingos, and one for him. Elio tells me that if it weren't for Domingos, he'd never be doing this. He also asks me to get to the point quickly. I press record. You ready? Okay, so I'm not going to introduce you. I'm just going to ask straight up. You're a young man living in Sabi. How old are you, sorry?
28 years old.
28 years old, same as me. So you would have been around 18, 17 when poaching really started coming to Sabi. I just wanted to know, when was the first time you personally heard about the concept of rhino poaching?
Rhino poaching is like from way long ago than that here, but the poaching started mainly here and to be in the crisis when the Chinese started entering the Mozambique.
And so was that because they set up companies here and businesses?
Bom, os chineses tinham contrato com Moçambique. Mas há uns chineses.
The Chinese, when they got here with their businesses and companies, opening companies, there was something else they were doing behind the scenario, like money laundering, because they had a lot of black market business behind like, the store, the illegal business that they had.
And so do you remember those people kind of coming around this community and recruiting young people to get into poaching?
No, é recrutamento. É vontade própria.
It's not like they recruited. It's someone's
unwilling to go there because of needs, because he wants money and like a lack of options, opportunities to survive.
Antigamente, muitos jovens dedicavam-se na trabalhavam na África do Sul.
Before this option, young people used to go to work in South Africa, but South Africa didn't like work that out for a lot of people, and they had to come back here. And in Mozambique, it was difficult because they couldn't have jobs, and to get a job, you would have to know someone who knows someone to help you to get that, or even pay someone who knows someone in order to get this job because of a lot of corruption. He was talking about that, and it was difficult.
Even when people could get jobs, were they getting paid very, very low wages? Was there a feeling that people were getting taken advantage of by the companies around?
Nós estamos a ser explorados mesmo, porque dinheiro mensalmente que você ganha no trabalhando.
Yes, we are being exploited in these companies, obviously, because the wages that they give us, it's not even enough, like even close to enough to sustain our families.
Não é muito atrás do tempo, é uma miséria isso.
It's not even about time. This is big misery.
I have seen one of these major construction projects on the outskirts of Sabi village. Large groups of men in navy jumpsuits walk to and from the site each day, their hands waving out on the road, asking for a ride from passers-by. Painted on the main gate is the Mozambican national flag, alongside the Chinese national flag.
Yes, the Chinese are here just because of a project. It's not factories. It's a project. It's a construction project. We have a main line, a pipeline from the dam to supply water in Maputo City. It's no longer a town, it's a city. I think it's a project of 2-3 years. So they will be finished. They will go away, yeah. Well, one part is keeping our young men busy, but other side, the Chinese, they are coming here just to colonize us in a different way, because they exploit a lot of people. They don't pay good salary. You can work many hours, but the salary is poor, you see.
And when you don't have any other option, you take it.
We have to take that option.
In a 2018 article published by The Guardian, Deputy Editor of Cities, Nick Van Mead, questions whether Chinese investment in Africa is mutually beneficial or a new kind of colonialism.
I think the manner in which it's done feeds into a colonial impulse.
That's Fiona Darrick. She's a lawyer who runs a social enterprise called Protimos. Protimos works with impoverished communities in Africa by building in-country legal hubs and training and supporting the professional development of local lawyers to enable those communities to use the law to protect their social, economic and environmental interests.
If you look at colonisation, it's a far more complicated thing than people just thinking, oh, I'm just going to move in here and take what I want. There's no doubt that at a time in the world's history when you could do that, you know, you could simply nip across to Africa or get on the Silk Road and do whatever it took to build your domestic economy. One might talk about colonial behaviour, but it's more complicated than that now. It's been made more complicated by the global economy. How would you describe Chinese conduct? The Chinese don't want to colonise the places that they go in. They just want the resources. They want them for their own economy. They're building. So if you talk about economic building, I'm not sure where the colony comes in, because the notion of colony for me means, you know, that you go in and you say, this land is mine. And you actually say, I am now going to build a mini UK in some corner of Zambia or somewhere like that. And I'm going to impose a court system. I'm going to build a railway for which you're all supposed to be very grateful. I'm going to try and turn everyone into Christians. You know, there are behavioural habits that indicate far deeper ambition for me, when you talk about colonization, what I think goes on is that people spot resources. They then work out what the cost of extracting those resources is going to be. And then they say, right, now we're going to get on with it.
When considering the extraction of African resources and the utilization of local workers by Chinese companies, it can be easy to forget that the West has evolved from the same forms of exploitation. Fiona Darick talks to Sophie about intellectual property laws when it comes to biodiversity, like that of Vietnamese or Chinese buyers of the rhino horn, but also as it applies to other African resources that are effectively stolen from indigenous communities and sold as product offshore, like rooibos tea, which I personally drink every day from a Dutch brand.
When I was, as I said, looking at IPRs and biodiversity, what I was thinking was, when the South African entities that decided to look at the rooibos plant first came to talk to the Bushmen about these resources, you know, they came in and they said, you know, can we take away some of this stuff because we'd like to look at it in the lab? Rooibos tea has got antioxidants and all sorts of other good things in it. And we think we could make a few bob out of this lot. But supposing there had been a lawyer who understood the Bushmen, and supposing the South African entities had accepted that unless they were talking to a lawyer about how to do this deal fairly, they didn't have a deal. And now that's my goal. That's my goal in all of this. If they can't withhold their consent, then it's not consent. You actually need to have two sets of lawyers. Just imagine you're sitting in the middle of the Amazonian rainforest and along comes, you know, Monsanto, and they say, look, we noticed that when you gave that mushroom soup to that granny over there who was foaming at the mouth and their eyes were rolling and all the rest of it, good Lord, didn't she calm down quickly and come back to normal after you'd given her that tisane of different mushrooms? I wonder if we could ask you for samples of each of the mushrooms and you could explain how you treat them. And then, you know, it's very likely that the shaman would say, I'm very happy to have a conversation with you. But then if the shaman then says, would you like to come into my hut? And I'd like now to introduce you to my lawyer.
Yeah.
You know what, Sophie? I have never recounted that before without people instantly laughing.
It feels like it would change everything.
That's it. That's exactly it.
Que países do terceiro mundo, do primeiro mundo, segundo mundo estão a viver bem.
Countries from the first world is living very well. Even the second world, they're living very well.
This is Elio again.
Eles estão nos explorar assim e ganham por nós.
They are really living that good life, exploiting Africa, the continent as a whole, and exploiting us all because, for example, we do not have industry. We don't have enough industries to produce our own products, so we have to import every time, and we depend on them to open their own companies in our country. For example, electricity, we have the dam here, but it gets transformed in South Africa to come back here. And
just to link it back to the rhino, what was your perception of the Kruger National Park and who was benefiting off the animals there?
Para África do Sul é muito...
Yes, that the rhinoceros in Kruger Park especially, it's like it's South African wealth, it's South African treasure, it's not ours, and we don't give a fuck to it. Even if we kill it, it's just a rhinoceros, it's not ours. Who gets benefit from it? It's just South Africans, not us, not Mozambique, because it's not ours. A rhinoceros is just a rhinoceros, and I can just take it down, just a rhinoceros.
Did poaching kind of feel like a way to take some of the wealth back or away from South Africa?
Posso me sentir assim.
Rhinoceros, yes, of course I can feel like that because I'm having a little bit of money to sustain my family. I go there, I can go there, just kill the rhinoceros, I just kill it, I bring it, the money that they will give me, I will use it to help my family with something. And even I can go there, die, or even stay here, die. So anyways, I will die.
For you, did poaching seem like it was going to be your ticket out of poverty, or did it seem? Did you know it would be a short-term solution?
Para mim que tenho noção de das coisas,
I could say that for me, it would be like a way to start up my life with the little of education that I have. I could know that I could use the money to start something that would help me further. That's what he said.
And is that what happened? Is that what you used the money for?
Yeah, muitas pessoas usam dinheiro para começar, mas acaba ser vício.
Well, he just started with yeah. Then he said, others go there and unfortunately get addicted to it, and they want always to go back and go back hunting rhinos.
This is where the figure of the Mozambican poacher comes in.
That is Jacob Dlamini, Assistant Professor of African History at Princeton University, whose work focuses on African environmental history. You heard from him in previous chapters.
A solution to the poaching problem lies in giving people alternatives, you know, lies in giving people a future, right? A future that people can look at and say, yeah, I can actually see my way out of this poverty. I can see my way out of this life of want. And of course, I'm not saying that poverty is what drives poaching, because I think it's much more complicated than that.
I'm wondering how you would do that. I mean, obviously, people always go to education is the answer, but I'm wondering what you think about that.
The obvious start would be to do what, you know, anthropologists like James Ferguson have been suggesting, which is to, in some ways, take seriously the fact that, you know, you don't have national economies in Southern Africa, but regional economies. What you need to do is to take seriously the idea that perhaps what the region needs is some sort of basic income grant. Because the gap between rich and poor is so vast that you can't just say giving people jobs will immediately solve the problem. But you could make a good start. What if we pooled resources and actually gave people just basic income grants as a start?
To live in Sabim, just my experience, I was bullied. I used to be bullied at school.
Domingos and I were on a drive through Sabi one day and got talking about self-esteem and judgment.
You come from Sabi, you don't even speak Portuguese. If you come from this small village and this traditional way of living, it affects somehow self-esteem. And these people, poachers, used to take care of cattle like all the day. Every day they would be on the bush, like it's raining, they would be under the trees. Who doesn't want to be in air condition in a car? Who doesn't want to be watching TV right now in very big screen TV? Who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want to be sitting in a sofa, especially if it's my own sofa? It's my own house, it's my own car I'm driving. Who doesn't want that?
Maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, what it's like to go and do the actual job of poaching.
I want to know from Elio what it's like to be on a hunt.
No, quando você já está balizado naquilo aí.
To go there and go to the bush, I mean, it's like being a soldier. If they say that there's war and you go to war, you know that you'll find an enemy with a weapon and he could shoot you. So you have to be ready for that. And that's the same. You have to prepare yourself to go poaching because you know that you are facing a kind of danger.
And how do people prepare themselves? Like, how do people get trained?
As pessoas ainda não estão preparadas para matar pessoas.
He's saying that no, the people doesn't even need to be trained for that because they do not want to kill rangers. They are not even prepared to kill people. They just go there for their rhino. They do not want to know about any other animals. They just go straight to the rhino and come back home. That's all they want.
Aquilo é uma adrenalina, papa. Aquilo é uma adrenalina. É que nem andar você 220 de carro. Você não sabe brigar de capotar.
He said, it's like, that's an adrenalina, bro. That's adrenalina. If it's like driving like 250 kilometers per hour, it's adrenaline, because you drive that speed, high speed, you know that you can have an accident and die. But it's good. It feels good. So it's just a kind of adrenaline.
Is it kind of like feeling high? Like on drugs?
Aquilo não precisa de droga, às vezes é ter espírito.
It doesn't need even drug. That's like spirit.
Going into the park, what are the roles of the different... How many people go in together and how does the structure work to try and be successful?
Um tem que ser atirador. Você atirando, tem que outro cortar.
One has to be the shooter and the other has to cut.
And is it usually people are just trying to get one per hunt? One horn?
Está a ver que vocês são duas pessoas. Aquilo também pesa também. Você não pode carregar 10 quilos.
Two, you wouldn't like want to have like others. You just hunt one and because of distance and it's heavy. And, well, you could die because you would have to walk maybe 75 kilometers. So carrying that 10 kilograms, for example, he was saying that would be too much. You could even die. But because of ambition, some people maybe would try to find some more.
Pessoas, você pensa que não são inteligentes quando são inteligentes.
You would be surprised about how smart some people are, how intelligent some people are, how creative some people are, how people just sit thinking and thinking on how to do something to and come out successful.
And how does it feel when poachers get out the park and they've succeeded?
Hey, I'm very emotional. Você é rich man. Você é muito emocionado.
It's exciting. Oh, it's so exciting. When you're out there, you feel like you're rich. You are a rich man. You feel it, you just feel it. You even think that you can buy like the earth and the sky. Well, while you're still very far from that. And if something you got it like not very in an honest way, when it comes to easy, it will go to easy. If it's not honest, well, it's not going to last.
So what happens then? What happens once you've come out? You've got this excited feeling.
Você é herói. Pode conseguir o que quer.
Well, after the emotion, you feel like you succeeded and you can do it more. You feel like you're a hero and you can do it more. More and more and more. But one day you'll regret.
Why?
Prisão em si pode condenar 10 anos de prisão.
You can be arrested, like prison, or death. But prison is the worst for me. Because your family suffers, everyone suffers, you suffer. Death would be better. If you kill me, it would be better. For me, he was saying.
Can you explain that more? Why would death be better than going to prison?
Morte será muito melhor para mim porque já tenho dias a sofrer. Melhor sofrer, morrer de uma vez.
Everyone dies and death would be better for me because once I'm gone, I'm gone. I'm just gone.
Do you think about what your family would suffer if you died out there?
É que nem morrer de doença. Minha família vai sofrer.
I could die with a disease here at home. My family would suffer. So because everyone dies, it's normal. But to be in prison, my family would suffer. I would suffer as well. So I'd rather die.
And so...
Is that how you express the big wow?
Yeah.
Yeah,
me
too. I was telling him like your answer was too big, that it was too tough, that she is still processing and bringing some questions.
Yeah, thank you. I'm still trying to wrap my head around why no one, like all these people that got into this very, very lucrative industry seem to not have any money left over.
Vai escada por escada. É desse jeito que eu estou a dizer. Você que vai para lá.
That's probably because it has these degrees. There is this structure, big structure of, for example, the poachers themselves and the senders and the people who benefit the most from it. And those who go poaching straight to the park, they come back, they don't have that much money. That's why they cannot like afford doing a lot of things. It's not like a visible wealth for them. The money that you get, you can only buy some food, maybe build a house and buy maybe a car. And then since you get the horn out of the park, you take it to Maputo. Maputo gets into the ship, it goes to maybe China, somewhere, whatever. It was using maybe. So you don't get much. So they benefit the most from this money, from this horn.
And so then after you've kind of spent it on the things that you need immediately, then you're kind of seduced to go back. And the cycle repeats.
Necessidades não acabam. Necessidades não acabam.
Needs never end. You always need something. And, well, if you do not have these good management skills of your money, you always need to go back. And if you do not have this entrepreneurial views, you will always need to go back.
And do you think that not knowing how to manage money links to not having access to education?
Yeah. Educação. Primeira coisa, educação.
Yes. Education is essential. And if you're not educated enough, you do not know what to do with your life. That's why you don't even give value to your own life.
Some of them, they have got some good brain. Others, they are not having a good brain.
Here's Bernardo again.
They get money. They think it's the end of the world. Now I'm a rich man. I want to show everyone that I'm rich. I can drive car. That money is flying again. I have to go back again, risking my life. We African, we have that problem. Financial discipline. We have to learn how to use money. We grow up in poor background. We never see what is money is. You don't know how to generate that money to become more money in future.
To make it sustainable.
Sustainable, yeah. You don't have that knowledge. We'll never get from even our parents. They are illiterate. They never went to school. They are not able even to write and read. Yeah? How can you get the education to save money?
When it comes to finding solutions or ideas of how to convince young men to not go into poaching, I'm struggling to see actual alternatives. If there's access to this excessive wealth very quickly, how do you convince someone to earn much, much less and work much harder when they're young and they now have technology that can show them the whole world and how people in the first world are living, and still expect a young person to be satisfied with just surviving?
Yeah, to convince. You know, most of the young people are getting there to poaching because they are not doing anything. They are relaxed. Yeah, and bored. We have to keep them busy to forget. If you are busy, you are doing something, you have time to go and poach. You don't have time. It's a problem of our government. It don't create some project for young people just to keep them busy. It's easy to convince a young man. But most of the young people here, yeah, they are sitting at home doing nothing. It's easy someone and come and say, hey, my friend, you need money. He's going to stand up immediately, say, yeah, I need money. Let's go. They are going to do silly things. You see, we have to keep our young people busy. Don't give them space to do silly things like projects, fishing, other activities like sport. We keep them busy.
Did you feel like the work that you were doing to go poaching, did you have a moral kind of complex about it, or did it just feel like this is something that you want to and are happy to do?
Vontade não, mas culpa não também.
Here is Elio again.
Like, happy to kill it, I wouldn't say so. Neither guilty because I'm doing it. That's just an animal. I'm just killing an animal, like I kill a chicken to eat. Me, myself, I'm not capable of killing a human being. I cannot kill a person. And what they're doing, they're militarizing the security of it, the conservation of the rhino, is too much just because of an animal. They shouldn't just kill people because of an animal. So they give much value to money than to a human being.
Do you think that race has anything to do with the poaching situation?
It has nothing to do with race.
When you hear that a poacher has been killed in Kruger National Park, what does it make you feel, and how does it kind of impact the community here?
Affect a comunidade porque é por nós é um jovem que tinha pode ter mais sucesso.
Yes, the community is affected, like, directly. If a young man dies there, it's like one young man who could maybe make changes in the community dies. One man less in the community, and probably would have maybe children at home, so it would leave his children without father, and a wife without husband, and a mother without son as well. He said, in my perspective, he's like resting from this misery.
The political scientist Achille Mbembe conceptualizes necropolitics as such. The ultimate expression of sovereignty resides, to a large degree, in the power and the capacity to dictate who may live and who must die. Necropolitics is often discussed as an extension of biopower, the Foucauldian term for the use of social and political power to control people's lives. Foucault presents biopower as a mechanism for protecting, but acknowledges that this protection often manifests itself as subjugation of non-normative populations. Mbembe uses the examples of slavery, apartheid, and the colonization of Palestine to show how different forms of necropower over the body reduce people to precarious conditions of life. In other words, those in power determine who thrives, who survives, and who dies. Do you think it's kind of interesting that people think that people here should be happy with just surviving and not thriving?
Yeah, it's easy to me to see how happy people should be in a very natural environment, for example, deep in Sabim. People, they're like living with what they produce themselves. You see that? It's easy for me because I'm living in a city. I'm watching that on TV. I can see that, oh my God, in Sabim people live like this. Oh, look at how beautiful this is. Oh, look at children. Look at these children are going to fetch water in a river. You see, where are you sitting? Air conditioned at home? You're watching that in big screen television with BBC channel or whatever. It's easy for you to just judge that, you know. You're like, ah, no, money doesn't make people happy. Well, true, it doesn't make people happy, but it makes people like live better lives. Maybe not happy, but at least you can pay your bills. You can help yourself. If they think we should be happy with the little we have, then they shouldn't be coming here to take these wealth, natural resources to make their life better. They should stop exploiting oil to drive cars, and they should stop exploiting minerals to make themselves cell phones, because, well, you don't need that. You should be happy with the little you have. And now you don't tell me I should be happy with the little I have. No. I want to thrive too, just like you did. Just like you did. Georgina, I need money. People need money. The world has brought this condition, right? Capitalism. Well, people started living in the West, driving fancy cars and using cell phones. Did that happen that way? So, they evolved, right? As we need to. How did your community live before We have our history, sure. And we're evolving, right? And we're evolving. Just like you are. For the West and China or whatever country, for them to evolve, they need Africa. With fair trade of our resources and their money, wouldn't happen. They wouldn't be like thriving this fast. So they need us uneducated. They need to make us believe that, well, it's our culture, we have to keep being like this. And they want us to be uninformed. They don't want us to believe that, yes, we can, and yes, we want. That's what they want from us.
One of the problems with trying to uncover invisible things is when focusing in and highlighting, you run the risk of emphasising the same details that have previously caused harm, of making the same division significant, and thus reinforcing the gaps. In his novel, Between the World and Me, Ta-Nehisi Coates writes, "But race is the child of racism, not the father. And the process of naming the people has never been a matter of genealogy and physiognomy, so much as one of hierarchy. Difference in hue and hair is old, but belief in the preeminence of hue and hair, the belief that these factors can correctly organise a society and that they signify deeper attributes, which are indelible. This is the new idea at the heart of these new people who have been brought up hopelessly, tragically, to believe that they are white." A lot of people in the first world that hear about rhino poaching through the media, mainly white mainstream media of the Western world, really despise poachers, and they dehumanise poachers through these journalistic media accounts of what's going on. And it's gotten to the point where when a poacher dies in the Kruger Park, people in the international community celebrate. I want to hear what you think about that and what you would say to those people directly.
Yeah, essas pessoas que estão a humilhar.
Here is Elio again.
So he just answered now, he just told the people, the Western people, that you guys are despising our work. You are humiliating us for what we do to survive. Because you guys were born rich and have everything on your tables, and you have everything you need. You have education. You could go to school, could get like mostly everything you needed. But we didn't. We don't. You didn't have to be violent to survive. You didn't have to hustle to survive. And we are trying to do that because we want to survive as well. And we need to do what we do, and you despising us.
É isso mesmo. Eles não precisam batalhar a vida para conseguir alguma coisa.
It's like they exactly. That's it. They didn't have to fight for life like we have. They have everything on the plate, and their parents give them on the mouth, like in the mouth.
Spoon feed them.
They were born with silver spoon in the mouth.
Parar de nos humilhar.
Please stop humiliating us. Because if we do what we do, it's not because we're stupid. There are others like much more stupid than us, because they kill people because of oil. People because of oil. And we just kill animals because of a little money. It's not because we're stupid. We're trying to survive like the others. Who is this? South African number? I'm sorry, I have to take this. Hello?
Domingos?
Hello, good evening.
You're speaking to Greg Domingos.
Okay, great. Sorry.
Hi, sorry, Greg. Greg, it's Georgie. Hi, sorry. Can I give you a call back in literally 2 minutes? Thank you so much. Thank you. I'll call you in two. Or message you. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Your uncle is then in South Africa?
I'm from South Africa.
Oh, you from South Africa?
I was born there, but I moved to Australia when I was very, very little.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He's just checking. Should we finish?
Acho que não teve aí junho.
E junho?
Yeah.
Tá bom.
Goodbye.
Tchau, tchau, mamãe. Tchau, tchau, Edilson.
Não, não posso sair.
Tchau, tchau.
Tchau, tchau. Eu também quero sair.
Tchau, olha, andar. Orgulho. Tchau.
Virar de tipo cá.
Você não passa nem assim.
Domingos.
Georgina. Don't want to say goodbye. Head goodbyes, please. Don't.
Aren't we doing this to say goodbye? Isn't that the whole point?
I know. It just hurts. I mean, you don't have to remind me that all the time.
Absolutely. Do you want a hug now?
Don't you?
Yeah, no, I do. Aww.
Thank you so much, Georgina.
I'm not saying thanks. No, it's okay.
Okay. Be careful, you're hurting me here.
Oh, get over it.
Okay. It hurt. Okay, that worked.
Well,
that
is.
Well, dude. Goodbye.
I've left Sabi Village. I take a wrong turn and end up on a 6-hour detour. I'm going round in circles, and not just in the car. I finally cross the border to South Africa and am back in the Kruger National Park. It's strange to think that an arbitrary line dividing these two landscapes can be so instrumental in governing people's lives, determining ownership, opportunity, access, and rights. It gets me thinking about arbitrary lines generally, drawn in the literal and figurative sands. Used to maintain division. Lines that help define things. Like those you don't want to cross when you're colouring in. The current outline of the Kruger keeps its internal shape the same. The Kruger as a concept. As a history. What it means to those who reinforce it. Cannot maintain its form if it is to address the issues of the surrounding communities. A new outline would have to be drawn, a new picture rendered. The German physicist Albert Einstein said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, much like the circles I've been driving in. Eventually, we have to get somewhere, and it might not look the way we'd hoped.
It's a very tricky one. That is one of the main reasons why I think we have so much effort going in now to bring the children in.
Head Ranger Ken Maggs is now facing his own rewrite, retirement, marking a potential new chapter for the Kruger.
To have, you know, a week where we have free access for the local communities, periods where they can come into the park and access. And there's no doubt we're seeing a lot more black visitors. But, you know, we've got to continue as an organisation, continue working on that, making sure we get people through the park. And that's also going to be a challenge for the Kruger, is that it can only take so many people before it becomes congested and really gets unpleasant. People management in the future is going to become one of the biggest challenges to make sure that you still have this balance.
And that you also have more diverse people coming to the park, and yet you can't necessarily price people out of it.
Yeah, you know, Sand Parks has to pay its way. Yeah. And so tourism in the park is absolutely critical. So yes, there's a balance there. But We have to get more of the community members passing through at every level, getting an understanding of how Kruger ticks and why it ticks. What's its sort of advantage for not only the community, but for South Africa and for the world? You know, what part does it play?
And those sentimental memories that a lot of you all share, you want the next generation of people of colour to be able to have so that they are attached to the park themselves.
No, absolutely. Okay, I retire now in 14 months' time, so it's going to be somebody else must take the baton. And those are the challenges. It's going to be an ever-increasing population and therefore community surrounding the park, and an increasing pressure on the park, not only from outside, but from inside, you know, tourists wanting to come in and enjoy the Kruger is going to become extremely challenging. But what is acceptable? If you asked Stevenson Hamilton, who was one of the first warden here many, many, many years ago, if he was to pop his head out of the grave today and you were to ask him that question, now he'd be horrified of what's happening now. We continue to change. And so what will the park look like in 10 years in terms of congestion? And what will we accept? In 20 years' time, where will we be? We certainly won't be there. We will have evolved further along. And the acceptance will be different.
Yeah, I can't help but feel this is a strong metaphor for what's happening in South Africa as a country, what's happening in the park right now. Would you agree with that?
Change is taking place on the continuum, and it's a question of, you know, how do you embrace that change? Are you able to embrace the change?
And just one last thing, do you feel like you will see, you know, even after you've left, you will see the war against the rhinos end?
No. I can't see it ending. We'll see maybe a reduction, there might be a shift, simply because there are fewer rhino and the risks are just simply too high. Are we going to get on top of the demand reduction? I honestly don't believe so. You will see when you go to Vietnam.
Okay, Greg.
Hi.
I'm back.
Welcome back. I'm glad you're back.
I'm back and I'm also leaving.
I'm sad about that too.
Okay, good, I just needed that on record. So the first question I wanted to ask was, how has it been for you? Like, I can imagine this is maybe the first time you've had your life and ideas and opinions kind of examined in a way that's going to be for the public. Has that something you've been thinking about when we've been together making it, or have you not really been thinking about the public aspect of it?
Yeah, I actually, to be honest with you, I haven't given it much thought. I'll be a surprise when, well, maybe I'll be surprised, I don't know. Maybe your portrayal of me will be different to what my own portrayal of myself would be. You know, I don't know. We'll see. I look forward to it. But I think what you will portray in your documentary will be what you yourself have seen and during your time here. It's what you will be translating, you know. Well, we'll wait and see. So best you have, yeah. You got to get to Vietnam and get this thing done.
Fuck, I know, I'm so tired. All right, cool. Is there anything else you want to say before you go?
Bye. It's been great. It really has. It's been very interesting as well. And the cool thing for me is you've sort of asked questions that I didn't think about before and didn't really give much thought to, which sort of has awakened sort of other curiosities and other questions which will probably remain unanswered, but it's, you know, that's food for thought.
Oh, Niels.
How's it, man?
Okay. Bye. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Okay, I'm going to open the gate for you.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you, hey?
Thanks.
Cheers.
Ciao. Bye. There are many things I don't raise with Greg now, even though I could and should. The politics of this documentary,
how those politics might frame some of his work. It's hard to confront the people you love about their power, especially whilst you're benefiting from it. This, I've been told, is how structural inequality is reinforced. There is a lot written on the ethics of documentary making, but no amount of research or attempts to understand the many theories can mitigate the personal blind spots which will shape the politics of whatever you make. This is an unsolvable problem we have come up against, argued about, and ultimately had to embrace. In one piece titled Speaking Truths with Film, Evidence, Ethics, Politics in Documentary, Bill Nichols argues that because of advancement in media technologies and changing fashions in art and storytelling, contemporary documentary has stylistically aligned itself more closely with narrative storytelling. Amongst other things, it has become less like a narrowly conceived form of social moralizing or short-term advocacy, and more like its fictional siblings. Creative nonfiction, a form or genre which Bill Nichols argues can explore more successfully the depth and complexity of human interaction and experience than traditional documentary tended to. Documentary fashion has grown to favour more personal, more cultural narratives. But with this heightened freedom in form and expression comes its own set of moral and political problems. Audiences read and watch and listen to fiction, knowing it's fiction. Knowing that the makers have total power in the crafting of an unreal world. An unreal world full of truths, but undeniably made up. Though in the era of alternative facts, many of us are becoming more aware of the need to be wary. Documentary and its history still position audiences to consume stories as a portrayal of reality. But the more the boundaries of creativity within the genre are pushed, the more the maker's power in crafting the narrative and their personal limitations of understanding shape what that reality looks like for you, the listener. Nearing the end of my time in Africa, I catch a concerning BBC News report about a virus that spreads.
The coronavirus continues to spread at speed. This time last week, we were talking about cases in under 40 countries. Now that figure is 67. There are also close to 90,000 cases worldwide, and the global death toll has gone past 3,000. Crucially, the vast majority of new cases are outside China. Here's the latest from the World Health Organization.
The stories we are told, particularly the simple ones, can create a sense of truth that's black and white. When reality exists in shades of grey, and many realities are invisible. Sometimes it's the invisible realities that carry the most violent power. That is what I've learnt from the endangered white rhino and the many events of this past year, 2020. The announcement of the pandemic and border closures halts the making of this documentary. Our next chapters were dedicated to the buyers, consumers, and prescribers of rhino horn as product. The invisible hand that drives demand and new forms of colonialism. Like a lot of things this year, it will have to wait. I've been your host, Georgina Savage, and you've been listening to The Invisible Hand. We'll be right back.
Invisible Hand was co-created and written by Georgina Savage and Sophie Side in partnership with Case File Presents. It was produced and edited by Georgina Savage. Research and narration written by Sophie Side. Graphic design by Marco Vuleta Djukanov. Original score, sound design, and soundtrack by me, Issa Williams.
We are seeking contacts on the ground in Vietnam and Hong Kong for the continuation of this series when international travel is available to us once more. If you know of anyone who buys, sells, consumes, or prescribes rhino horn and might be willing to talk to us about their experiences, please contact Georgina Savage at the email address provided in the show notes.